Državni izpitni center. Splošna matura 2020. Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine. Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak. Rešitve pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor znotraj okvirja. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami. Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha. Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear three speakers talking about three different paintings. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task. Speaker A.
Louise Govier from the National Gallery's Adult Education Department.
What we're looking at is the moment when a god meets a mortal woman and falls in love with her. We've got Ariadne, who has been abandoned by her husband. She wakes up on a seashore and finds that his boat is just sailing off into the distance. You can just see it over her shoulder. She's crying, she's waving goodbye and kind of calling him back. And then all of a sudden, as she's standing there, she hears this tumultuous noise. This is actually a group of followers of the god of wine, Bacchus, who have been partying. And we see just how much they've been partying. They've been drinking, they're playing music, they've ripped animals into bits because they've been having such a frenzied time. They come through the forest and Bacchus sees her and immediately falls in love. And he leaps off his chariot. I mean, she looks terrified because, of course, you know, it's a madman coming and jumping off towards her. Also, he's not wearing very much. He's naked apart from a very beautiful piece of pink drapery that just about covers up his bits, but we see he's got a very nice body otherwise. It's a moment of love at first sight, real thunderbolt stuff, but also there are moments of humour within this, and this love story is not at all about elegance. And of course, that's something we can all relate to. All of us have seen somebody and thought, blimey, you'll do. And all of us have had moments where we can just think, yes, I wasn't quite at my best. I'm not quite sure what I did last night, but you know, hey.
Speaker B.
James Heard from the National Gallery's Adult Education Department.
This is Mr. Andrews with his new wife. We think it's a marriage portrait. Mind you, they don't look too happy, do they? The landscape tells us what Mr. Andrews did. He was a farmer, a gentleman farmer, and the estate that he owned is behind him. And basically what's happened is they've just stepped out of their house and had their portrait painted. But actually, the reality is he almost certainly painted them inside, one at a time, then constructed the landscape around them. And of course, put in the dog, which is very important, because if you look at that dog, his nose is like an arrow pointing up to Mrs. Andrews' face. So the artist uses various devices to get you to look at those faces. And there's something rather interesting about this painting. If you look carefully at Mrs. Andrews' hands, you can see there's a strange, rather neutral patch there. He never finished what he was going to paint. We don't know what it was. Some people think, well, it might have been a pheasant that Mr. Andrews had just shot. Some people think that she may well have been pregnant at this point. We don't really know. All we know is Gainsborough never went back to finish the painting.
Speaker C.
Colin Wiggins, National Gallery's Head of Education.
Christina of Denmark, Duchess of Milan. She's 16 years old and she's a widow, wearing widow's clothes. You look at her hand and you'll see her wedding ring. She doesn't seem to be too upset that she's a widow, but the marriage to her husband, the Duke of Milan, was arranged for her. And when he died, well, she's on the marriage market again. This picture was made by Hans Holbein, a German artist who was working in London, and it was actually made for a prospective husband who sent Holbein to meet Christina and to paint her likeness, to take it back to him to see if he liked her. And the prospective husband was called Henry VIII. And Henry VIII, as I'm sure you know, got through wives like there was no tomorrow. This particular prospective wife certainly tickled his fancy, because the story goes that when he saw the picture, he went straight up to it and planted a big wet kiss on the lips, which conservationists now, of course, try to persuade people not to do to old master paintings. But of course, Henry had paid for the picture. This was going to be his wife. Christina of Denmark was spared the fate of marrying Henry. The marriage negotiations fell through. And in fact, Christina later in her life is reported to have said that she was very glad that she didn't marry Henry, because she felt she was rather too attached to her head.
Now you will hear the recording again. Speaker A.
Louise Govier from the National Gallery's Adult Education Department.
What we're looking at is the moment when a god meets a mortal woman and falls in love with her. We've got Ariadne, who has been abandoned by her husband. She wakes up on a seashore and finds that his boat is just sailing off into the distance. You can just see it over her shoulder. She's crying, she's waving goodbye and kind of calling him back. And then all of a sudden, as she's standing there, she hears this tumultuous noise. And this is actually a group of followers of the god of wine, Bacchus, who have been partying. And we see them, we see just how much they've been partying. They've been drinking, they're playing music, they've ripped animals into bits because they've been having such a frenzied time. They come through the forest and Bacchus sees her and immediately falls in love, and he leaps off his chariot. I mean, she looks terrified because, of course, you know, it's a madman coming and jumping off towards her. Also, he's not wearing very much. He's naked apart from a very beautiful piece of pink drapery that just about covers up his bits, but we see he's got a very nice body otherwise. It's a moment of love at first sight, real thunderbolts stuff, but also there are moments of humour within this, and this love story is not at all about elegance. And of course, that's something we can all relate to. All of us have seen somebody and thought, blimey, you'll do. And all of us have had moments where we can just think, yes, I wasn't quite at my best. I'm not quite sure what I did last night, but you know, hey.
Speaker B.
James Hurd from the National Gallery's Adult Education Department.
This is Mr. Andrews with his new wife. We think it's a marriage portrait. Mind you, they don't look too happy, do they? The landscape tells us what Mr. Andrews did. He was a farmer, a gentleman farmer, and the estate that he owned is behind him. And basically what's happened is they've just stepped out of their house and had their portrait painted. But actually, the reality is he almost certainly painted them inside, one at a time, then constructed the landscape around them. And of course, put in the dog, which is very important, because if you look at that dog, his nose is like an arrow pointing up to Mrs. Andrews' face. So the artist uses various devices to get you to look at those faces. And there's something rather interesting about this painting. If you look carefully at Mrs. Andrews' hands, you can see there's a strange, rather neutral patch there. He never finished what he was going to paint. We don't know what it was. Some people think, well, it might have been a pheasant that Mr. Andrews had just shot. Some people think that she may well have been pregnant at this point. We don't really know. All we know is Gainsborough never went back to finish the painting.
Speaker C.
Colin Wiggins, National Gallery's Head of Education.
Christina of Denmark, Duchess of Milan. She's 16 years old and she's a widow, wearing widow's clothes. You look at her hand and you'll see her wedding ring. She doesn't seem to be too upset that she's a widow, but the marriage to her husband, the Duke of Milan, was arranged for her. And when he died, well, she's on the marriage market again. This picture was made by Hans Holbein, a German artist who was working in London, and it was actually made for a prospective husband who sent Holbein to meet Christina and to paint her likeness, to take it back to him to see if he liked her. And the prospective husband was called Henry VIII. And Henry VIII, as I'm sure you know, got through wives like there was no tomorrow. This particular prospective wife certainly tickled his fancy, because the story goes that when he saw the picture, he went straight up to it and planted a big wet kiss on the lips, which conservationists now, of course, try to persuade people not to do to old master paintings. But of course, Henry had paid for the picture. This was going to be his wife. Christina of Denmark was spared the fate of marrying Henry. The marriage negotiations fell through. And in fact, Christina, later in her life, is reported to have said that she was very glad that she didn't marry Henry, because she felt she was rather too attached to her head.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Roma Agrawal, a structural engineer. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
But first, structural engineer Roma Agrawal is here, has worked on many a famous building, including the Shard Roma, and you've written this book, Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures. I guess the central idea I took away from your book is that the buildings around us, the monuments around us, aren't sort of frozen images of a moment in time, but the sort of physical conclusion to often weaved and meandering narratives. What do Chinese and Indian concrete tell us, or how do they illustrate your point?
Yes, so concrete is a particular favourite of mine, in fact, and it's got this amazing story and history to it. And I only know snippets of it because we've lost information from big chunks of time. So we know about Roman concrete. We know that they added in porcelainic ash that they found near a volcano, which made it able to set underwater, which was a huge innovation at the time. We then lost it in the West for a long time. In the meantime, we see China and India mixing really interesting materials into their concrete. So we know that the dome of the Taj Mahal has been analysed and known to contain sugar, gum, egg whites, all sorts of material. And it's said that the Great Wall of China has got sticky rice mixed into the concrete that, you know, joins the stones together, which allows a bit of movement. So, you know, as movement occurs, which is very natural, the mortar is basically less likely to crack.
Talking about movement, you worked on the Shard. I was amazed to discover that the Shard sways by up to a metre. Why does that happen?
Well, so every single skyscraper and every single building moves. So we can't fight against nature to the extent where our buildings are completely static. It's not
mildly
possible.
Scary, isn't it?
You can't feel it. So this is where, if the engineering is done correctly, you won't be able to feel it. So if you think about any of the towers in Manhattan, they all move. And I talk a little bit about how their stability system is like that of a tree. So we essentially put a trunk down the centre of a building, which is one way to do it. And as the wind hits, or as earthquakes hit, in fact, then this trunk of the building basically has a slight sway to it, but it keeps the building stable.
Fascinating. And skyscrapers are part of a historic tradition in architecture of reaching up to the heavens, aren't they? Throughout the history of buildings and monuments, there's always been an attempt to either reach up to heaven or even recreate it. And that's often, according to your book, being a sort of story about human ambition and human aspiration.
Yeah, so engineering for me is very, very much about what makes us human. So, you know, we as humans, we want to better ourselves, we want to challenge the limits, we want to achieve new things, and we do that in all walks of life. And engineering is definitely definitely one of them. And, you know, I think we'll see that trend continuing. We will build longer bridges, taller towers, deeper tunnels. And it's exciting. I think we've got lots of amazing technology that's, you know, on its way, that's going to allow us to evolve to the next step very soon.
Now you will hear the recording again.
But first, structural engineer Roma Agrawal is here, has worked on many famous buildings, including the Shard, Roma, and you've written this book, Built, The Hidden Stories Behind Our Structures. I guess the central idea I took away from your book is that the buildings around us, the monuments around us, aren't sort of frozen images of a moment in time, but the sort of physical conclusion to often weaved and meandering narratives. What do Chinese and Indian concrete tell us, or how do they illustrate your point?
Yes, so concrete is a particular favourite of mine, in fact, and it's got this amazing story and history to it. And I only know snippets of it because we've lost information from big chunks of time. So we know about Roman concrete. We know that they added in porcelainic ash that they found near a volcano, which made it able to set underwater, which was a huge innovation at the time. We then lost it in the West for a long time. In the meantime, we see China and India mixing really interesting materials into their concrete. So we know that the dome of the Taj Mahal has been analysed and known to contain sugar, gum, egg whites, all sorts of material. And it's said that the Great Wall of China has got sticky rice mixed into the concrete that, you know, joins the stones together, which allows a bit of movement. So, you know, as movement occurs, which is very natural, the mortar is basically less likely to crack.
Talking about movement, you worked on the Shard. I was amazed to discover that the Shard sways by up to a metre. Why does that happen?
Well, so every single skyscraper and every single building moves. So we can't fight against nature to the extent where our buildings are completely static. It's
not mildly scary, isn't it?
You can't feel it. So this is where, if the engineering is done correctly, you won't be able to feel it. So if you think about any of the towers in Manhattan, they all move. And I talk a little bit about how their stability system is like that of a tree. So we essentially put a trunk down the center of a building, which is one way to do it. And as the wind hits, or as earthquakes hit, in fact, then this trunk of the building basically has a slight sway to it, but it keeps the building stable.
Fascinating. And skyscrapers are part of a historic tradition in architecture of reaching up to the heavens, aren't they? Throughout the history of buildings and monuments, there's always been an attempt to either reach up to heaven or even recreate it. And that's often, according to your book, being a sort of story about human ambition and human aspiration.
Yeah, so engineering for me is very, very much about what makes us human. So, you know, we as humans, we want to better ourselves, we want to challenge the limits, we want to achieve new things. And we do that in all walks of life. And engineering is definitely one of them. And, you know, I think we'll see that trend continuing. We will build longer bridges, taller towers, deeper tunnels. And it's exciting. I think we've got lots of amazing technology that's, you know, on its way, that's going to allow us to evolve to the next step very soon.
This is the end of Section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo položite na rob mize. Nasvidenje in srečno.